Hey there, everybody. Welcome to Fan Tide, the podcast for all those complex and complicado conversations about the gray areas in our lives. I'm entertainment journalist, cultural critic, and world changer, Travell Anderson.
And I'm pretending complicado is a word, also known as Jared Hill, politics and pop culture journalist. Coming up on the show today, we are going to take a look at what it's like to be black in the newsroom where it happens in our Fan Tide discussion. And you'll find out why George is on our mind and why we've got John Boyega back in our dishonorable mentions.
It's a good thing.
Okay, all right, it's an honorable mention. I don't know, I haven't looked at your mentions, and I know that's one of yours. But before we get into all that, we've got a tough question.
Yes, a tough question is our opportunity to grapple with, you know, these conversations, these questions in particular that there is no clear answer to. And this week's a tough question grows out of the moment that we all are experiencing. And by moment, I obviously mean the continued pillaging of my people.
Wow. We pull pillage out of the archives.
Listen, okay, SAT word, honey. All right. So there have been a lot of conversations about like defunding police departments, about abolishing police, about the roles that like individuals can play in this movement, in this revolution that seems to be unfolding. And I've been thinking a lot about black police officers, black military folks like in the National Guard who've been called into some of these cities, and what they might be feeling like. And to be clear, not in a woo-woo-woo type of way, but in a...
But also that.
But, well, maybe. But mainly because I'm like, a lot of people are asking and demanding that folks like, you know, take decisive action to be in favor of this moment and in support of this movement. And so the tough question this week is, should black law enforcement officers, black military members quit their jobs in service of the movement?
I think this is a really difficult one. It's a tough one, even, if you will, when it comes to questions. I will tell you that my uncle is a retired sheriff. My stepdad is a retired police officer. My uncle was in the Marines. My grandfather...
Oh, so you believe Blue Lives Matter.
...served in...
Y'all gotta see his face right now.
Wow.
Just kidding.
My grandfather fought in World War II. Like, I have a lot of veterans. My, you know, best friend is an FBI agent. Like, I have a lot of friends and family who are law enforcement or military, and like, I have a profound respect for them and what they do. And I feel like that perspective has helped me to understand how difficult it is to be black in those spaces. Because I don't think enough people think enough about, you know, we always talk about what it's like to come encounter with the police, to have an encounter with the police and be black. But we don't often think about what is it like to work with that police officer and you're black, right? If you're Derek Chauvin's, you know, partner, or if you're on the same force with him, what has that been like for black folks that work with him? Black and brown folks, right? Non-white people. What is it like to work the neighborhood where George Zimmerman lives, right? And you're a black police officer. What is it like to be that person and experience racism in the way that you do? And so I feel for all of those people, all of the black and brown police officers and law enforcement and military and National Guard and what have you. But to the question of like, should they be quitting their jobs? I don't think it's that simple, right? Like, I don't think like it's wiping them all out, because then like they all have to be replaced, seemingly, right? By someone. And like, whenever we see people leave positions like this, especially like right now, I'm always intrigued by like the people that follow them and who come into those positions. And like, oftentimes those people are probably not going to be black and brown. I worry about the idea of like this mass exodus, but I do also think that the ideas around defund police come with some merit. So it's a challenging, tough question, if you will. What do you think?
Well, so two movies come to mind in this conversation that popped in my head as you were thinking. The first one is Boys in the Hood. Boys in the Hood pops in my mind because when I was at the LA Times covering protests back in the day, this was around the Ferguson-related protests here in LA. I remember being out in front of LAPD, and there was one black cop lined up in front of LAPD as protesters were just like, you know, berating all of them. But him in particular, he was getting a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And I remember someone saying, one of the protesters saying, like quoting Boys in the Hood, saying that there's no place for a black man in a white man's army. Right. And that stuck out to me and has stuck with me, them telling him that. I believe the movie is Boys in Hood. The second movie comes to mind is of Monster. It's called Monsters and Men. It was from 2018. I believe Reynaldo and Ernesto Green is the director of that. Reynaldo Marcus Green, excuse me. And that is a movie that's like told in three different kind of stories with three different subjects. And one of the subjects is a black police officer who's on a team in a department where some white dude, you know, killed somebody a la Eric Garner. Mm-hmm. And I, when I think of these particular conversations around what black police officers, black people in the military should do, I'm kind of conflicted as well, because, you know, I don't want nobody to stop their check.
Listen, because that's really what it boils down to.
And if you're in the military, you know, there can sometimes be great benefits. You know, my mom was in the military, well, she was in the Army for 23 years, most of my life at this point. And, you know, it allowed me and afforded me the opportunity to become this fabulous being that you all see and hear before you.
That we tolerate and deal with. I would say, but I think to your point, to part of this is like, I also don't like the idea of ripping away the dream of any black person who aspired to that, right? Like, I think about that often with Colin Kaepernick, and like the idea of like, well, just go do something else. And I'm like, if you are a professional football player, chances are very high that you worked your entire life to get to the NFL.
Yes.
And the idea that like you are going to go play Canadian ball or go play in Europe or go move somewhere else to another country where you know probably no one to go play a game that you should be able to play where you're from. That's never sat well with me either. And I think the same thing about police officers and military folks. Like, there are a lot of people in the military who like aspired to be in the military, who grew up like with military and military folks in their family. And same thing with law enforcement, and like aspired to that. And I know that my brother back in 2016 was telling me that he was considering becoming a police officer. And I was like, I'm sorry. And and he was considering the military or going into law enforcement or into the military. And I told him, like, you know, I would never say don't do it, but I would say be thoughtful and cautious about it, especially in the middle of that election. And I was saying, like, I wouldn't go be in a military where Donald Trump was, you know, the commander in chief, but that's a decision you have to make, right?
Right.
And I thought to myself, like, if that was something that he wanted to do it because he believed in the ideals of what this country was supposed to represent, and he wanted to go in there and be able to make it different or make it better. And like, I have a lot of respect for black folks who want to go in and make it better or want to be the representative face. You and I do work in being the representative faces in journalism with NABJLA, which we'll talk about later. But like, there have to be people there that can be making it better, because how else is it going to get any better?
I don't know if the idea of them quitting their jobs is the route to be taking, right, in this conversation. I also, to be clear, don't know what is the right route, particularly as we have these conversations about, you know, defunding police departments and eventually, I assume, abolishing the police in favor of some other form of like community policing.
I know we have a lot of listeners who probably hear defund the police and think, okay, wait, what? And I think it's important to recognize, like, defunding the police is something that people are discussing because, number one, there are myriad ways that we could reallocate that money, those hundreds of millions of dollars that go to police departments, that could go into things that inherently reduce crime, right? If we improved education, if we improved, you know, people's housing, economic situations, if we had housing, right? Instead of like all of those police officers having to police the homeless could be either living somewhere or in some kind of a program to better them, better their lives. And like, we would reduce the crime that comes from homelessness. We would reduce the crime that comes from, you know, being undereducated or not having a job or living in a difficult space or whatever it is. And so like, the idea is like, we spend so much money on policing these people, but we could also spend a lot of that money on making these people's lives better so they wouldn't need to be policed. And I think that is a lot of what goes into defund the police.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the purpose of this segment is, right, it's a tough question and we don't necessarily have the answer to it, but I think it is something to think about as we, you know, have these conversations about the movement and what's currently, you know, unfolding out in them streets. So, yeah. Uh-huh.
So you want every Black person to leave their job. Got it.
That's not what I said.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about what I've been saying is what it's like being Black in the newsroom where it happens. We've seen a lot of different situations happening around the country where newsrooms are getting a little bit more interesting. When we come back, we'll talk to you about that. Don't go anywhere. Hey, it's Jarrett. We just wanted to jump in for a quick moment to let you know a little bit about Max Fun. Our business model here is that we are artist-owned and audience-supported, which basically means when you become a member, you are directly affecting our ability to continue making this show and all the different shows across the Max Fun network. You get to select which show on the network you want to support. Let me say that again. You get to select which show on the network you want to support. Like, Fanti, and your contributions are allocated accordingly.
So we know that this is a very kind of uncertain time for a lot of people, but we've received your text messages, not really your text messages because y'all don't got our number, but we've received your tweets, your Instagram DMs, and your emails asking how you can support us. This is the way that you can do that, by pledging $5 a month, $10 a month, whatever level is comfortable for you, and that will allow us to continue producing this fabulous work that you just love eating up every week.
So make sure to go to MaximumFun.org/join for more information on how you can be a member at Max Fun. That's MaximumFun.org/join.
We are the host of My Brother and Me, and now, nearly 10 years into our podcast, the secret can be revealed. All the clues are in place, and the world's greatest treasure hunt can now begin.
Embedded in each episode of My Brother and Me is a micro clue that will lead you to 14 precious gemstones all around this big, beautiful blue world of ours.
So start combing through the episodes. Let's say starting at episode 101 on.
Yeah, the early episodes are pretty problematic, so there's no clues in those episodes.
No, not at all.
The better ones, the good ones, clues ahoy.
Listen to every episode repeatedly in sequence. Laugh if you must, but mainly get all the great clues. My Brother and Me, it's an advice show, kind of, but a treasure hunt, mainly. Anywhere you find podcasts or treasure maps, My Brother and Me, the hunt is on.
Welcome back to Fanti. Over the last few weeks, we've seen institutions scrambling to respond to the current moment by publicly acknowledging Black Lives Matter. But just a few months ago, it would have been hard to imagine the NFL, NASCAR, and even Mitt Romney supporting the movement. But we're also witnessing a reckoning within our institutions, an awareness that the status quo is no longer acceptable. We need change and action. This is the case for police departments across the country and also newsrooms. For this week's Fanti, we are going to really jump in and unpack what we love about the newsroom as well as its problems. And if you've been following the news, you know that there are many problems. Over the last few weeks, honey, we've been talking a lot about, or at least hearing a lot about, race following the murders of Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor. And then the simultaneous entries into the zeitgeist of videos showing Amy Cooper's manufactured horror on the phone, which I'm hearing there's like legislation coming up about that right now. And then also we're all really been triggered by this George Floyd video, watching him slowly be murdered by the Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. Floyd's death has really sparked a nationwide global protest. Floyd's death sparked a statewide, then nationwide, and then global protest calling for the end of racism and anti-Blackness. But while covering the Minneapolis protest, CNN reporter Omar Jimenez was arrested live on the air by Minneapolis police for allegedly standing in the wrong place while broadcasting to the world. Take a listen.
I'm sorry?
You're under arrest.
Okay. Do you mind telling me why I'm under arrest, sir?
Why am I under arrest, sir?
So as you can hear, he is being arrested while he's live on the air. And I have to tell you, to be quite honest, this was a moment that really, really triggered me. And like, I had spent that whole week feeling like, I'd said to someone that I felt like I was just really fragile all week. Like, I had been fine, but I kind of felt like the wrong thing at the wrong moment could break me. And for some reason, the combination of everything that had happened that week and then seeing Omar Jimenez, like, that was, that was the first thing that made me cry that day. That Friday, I cried four different times. And like, I felt like that could have easily been me, or easily been one of so many people that I know, especially mm-hmm. with working within ABJLA. Like, we know Black journalists across this country. And so many of them we watch on television every day. And so I was really, really like jarred by watching that video, because it could have gone any kind of a way. And I know that Omar talked about being really grateful that the camera was there. And yeah. He knows that were they not, it could have gone any kind of way.
Yeah. So like that happened. And then I feel like a number of kind of moments involving Black journalists, journalists of diverse backgrounds started happening kind of in rapid succession. Right. So I'll go through some of them fairly quickly. So Variety magazine is a trade publication, entertainment publication. Their EIC, Claudia Eller, published a piece on June 3rd titled "Reflecting Diverse Voices Starts in the Newsroom." And she basically talks about how she hasn't done as much as she should be doing to ensure that her newsroom is diverse. FYI, the Variety newsroom, they have one Black person on staff. I know her name. Shout out to Angelique.
Can we even hang there for a moment? You and I have had many different conversations about Variety specifically, right? Like, yeah. I've had stories published at Variety, but like, I'm always there as a freelancer, never there as a staff writer. And like, we know that this is like a major problem with a lot of the different trades. And like, Variety is like the main one that's catching it right now, though.
Yeah, I mean, but they're catching it, right? Because she published this story, Claudia Eller, their editor-in-chief, published this story, and then a former reporter of color, she's not Black, she's Southeast Asian, I believe, South Asian, but believe, Pia Sinha Roy, I hope I didn't butcher her name, but I'm sure I did. She shared a little bit of her experience when she formerly worked at Variety, and about how she had these conversations about the need for diversity and inclusion with Claudia Eller and her co-editor-in-chief at the time, and how it didn't really go anywhere. Claudia responded by saying that Pia was bitter. And that kicked off kind of an internal newsroom conversation about her behavior, but also about their diversity. And so as a result of that, Claudia was put on a 2-month leave, administrative leave, while they, I guess, figure out whether she returns, what increasing their newsroom diversity can look like, etc. In addition to that, the editor-in-chief of the Philadelphia Inquirer, he stepped down. He resigned a couple days ago after discontent regarding a headline that the publication published that said buildings matter too. And it was an op-ed in response to some of the destruction that's happening of the different buildings. The Los Angeles Times leadership reached out to their newsroom and made it a verbal commitment again to increase diversity, to atone for the ways that the paper has been like historically racist to a variety of different communities. And then there was also the New York Times opinion editor who resigned following the op-ed they published from Senator Tom Cotton about sending in the troops to quell the protests and the unrest that we see happening.
Ridiculous.
Refinery 29's editor-in-chief stepped down after former women of color who worked at that publication started talking about the culture of racism and just kind of not feeling welcome in that particular place. And there are so many other different things happening in media. It appears as if this reckoning, right, this revolution that's happening in the streets is spilling over into the newsrooms. There are a variety of different, like, outcomes and a variety of different kind of, I guess, conversations that are now happening. But before we kind of delve into all of that, you know, I know you and I talk about we're very proud, I think, to be journalists, and we take great joy out of like the responsibility that we've shouldered in being journalists. Let's talk about the fan part of this conversation. Like, why did you become a journalist?
I became a journalist. My background there is kind of like storied. So like my dad always loves to tell the story that like I was a little boy. I was probably, you know, 7 or 8 years old, and he's cooking in the kitchen. But he was like, didn't hear me. And you know, like when it gets too quiet and there's a child in the house, you get a little bit worried. Mm-hmm. And like he found me like in the bathroom mirror talking into a hairbrush like I was a television reporter, right? And so like when I became a television reporter, he reminded me of that moment, saying like this was always something that was going to happen for you. But like my actual career in journalism started in 11th grade. My 10th grade English teacher was becoming the advisor for the newspaper, and I guess he thought I was a good writer or whatever. and told me that
boy, was he wrong.
I'm gonna just let this pause be so pregnant. But he was like, I think you should be on the newspaper. And I always say, like, I told him, I think you're wrong. And like, I like was resistant to be on the newspaper because it didn't seem fun or cool. But I did eventually join. And like, I spent my 11th and 12th grade years really, really invested in the paper and like really seeing like a lot of value in it. But it was also the first time that I'd interviewed someone and written a story and offered it for people to read. And like one of the first stories that we ever did, and I think I told the story on an older episode, but like we did a story on kids kissing on campus, and what was mind blowing to me, exactly, it was really scandalous at the time, in 11th grade,
fast ass kids.
It was a big deal that we did this story, and like the PTA had meetings and the school board had something to say, and like there was so much to say, and it was the first time I ever got the understanding of like the power of telling a story, right? Of being able to share an experience. Storytelling has always been really high value for me. So what about you?
I don't know. I feel like my story is a little bit similar to you. Like, I mean, I wasn't caught in the mirror doing nothing appropriate that I can share on the podcast.
Wow. That took
and
a turn.
Appropriate is in air quotes. But I think I started journalism and writing also in high school. It was a professor who she actually was, I forget her name, but she was the advisor for the Model United Nations team that I was on. And, you know, anybody who knows about Model UN, if you take it seriously, there's a lot of writing, there's a lot of research and all of that. And she was like, oh, I think you should join the newspaper, because she also was in charge of our Convergence Media Magnet program that had all these different sectors or whatever. And so Miss Brooks actually was the one who was in charge of the newspaper. And that's how I just started writing. And I started writing opinion pieces, which, you know, we love to tell our opinion. And then I went to Morehouse and joined the newspaper there, the Maroon Tiger. And I never thought I was going to be a journalist, but I had just always been on the student newspaper, changed my major 12 million times. And then finally, it was senior year. And I was like, girl, the most consistent thing in your life over these last 6 years or so has been journalism. Try it on for size. But I would similarly say to you that one of the reasons why I love being a journalist is the interviewing. It is the storytelling. It is the ability of like passing the microphone to these communities who they have voices. They're not voiceless, but no one's listening, right? And so I love the ability to be able to listen to these people and help them tell their particular story.
I love what you said there, because I never liked the language of we're giving voice to the voiceless. I think everyone has a voice. I think everyone has a story. Everyone doesn't always have a platform to be able to stand up and use that voice. So I'm just 100% there with you on that.
Now in this particular moment, we're talking about being Black journalists. What do you, I don't know if this is a weird question, but like, what do you love most about being a Black journalist in particular?
I just want to let people know that here in our document, he wrote this as, what do you love about being a Negro journalist? I just want to put that out there. I will say that something that I've grown to love about being a Black journalist, or Negro journalist, as Travell would put it, has been the community of Black journalists that I've become a part of. When I wasn't always like a traditional journalist working in news. Like I worked in news and then I kind of went out of it and I started producing in talk shows and doing other things in reality. And then I came back into news. And so I've had like a very different like news path than most of the folks that I work with and know and admire. But I will say that when I came back into the journalism side, within a couple of years, the Melania Trump situation happened with the speech and I broke that story. And then like I got introduced to the journalism community of NABJ, and like I valued it so much, because to me, the community of Black journalists that I've met have made it so much better for me to be a journalist. And I felt heard, I felt understood, I felt seen, I felt all of those things. And I've also felt like this real value in the work, as opposed to in previous jobs where I would always have to second guess myself and like wonder if I was doing good work and wonder if I was, you know, if maybe I am doing this the wrong way, or maybe I shouldn't, you know, speak this way, or maybe I shouldn't do that with my hair or whatever. that is what I've enjoyed, but I've also enjoyed getting to tell the stories of Black and brown people who, similarly to you were saying, don't always get heard, don't always get printed, don't always get, you know, a microphone in front of them to be able to tell their story. And I enjoy, like, them being able to say to me, like, oh, I've never gotten to tell my story before, or I've never gotten asked that question before, because it's always a white journalist, or no one's ever been able to, you know, to care about what I was thinking. What about you?
I mean, I just love
being
black.
You knew this question was coming, don't?
I did, but you know, I don't think about it in advance because I want it to be, you know, off the cuff for the peoples. But I think that I wrote in our script document, everybody, I wrote, I care like Beyonce.
I wasn't going to put you out there on that, but.
But I think that's it. I think that's why I love being a black journalist, is because I feel like black journalists, we care in a way that is just different than journalists who aren't black.
Yeah.
And not only about other black people and black stories, but about diverse stories of all types of stripes, right? And I love the idea of, I remember when I worked at the LA Times, going out into the community and me being the person, being the one interviewing, you know, black and brown folks, how that would signal a shift in their thinking of what their relationship to media could be, and how I was seen as, you know, some sort of proof of change or proof of growth within the community, and within the community's relationship to media, particularly in a city like LA, where, you know, black folks, brown folks, literally everybody folks don't like the press generally, with reason, with great reason.
A lot of trust has been broken.
Plenty trust, okay? And so yeah, I think that's what I love most about being a black journalist. And then you mentioned the community. I would second that. But with all of that, right, has also come a lot of shit. It's come a lot of foolishness.
And before we pivot to the anti part, you just mentioned something that I think is super duper important. I was talking to friends this week. I launched this campaign called #EveryDay, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But one of the things that I have really been intrigued by with reading all of these different stories of black folks that are experiencing everyday racism has been, like, I've not read the same story twice. And that has been really, really interesting to me. You would think that when you have this many people telling their stories of experiencing racism, you'd hear, like, oh, the same kind of thing a few times. But I've not read the same story twice. And kind of to what you were saying, hearing all of these different people's stories, even though I've not heard that story, like, I can relate to the story because there's elements of that story that I've either experienced or that I've heard from a friend or a colleague or a co-host or whomever, a family member that I know, like, oh, yeah, my mom had that happen, or yeah, my sister had that happen. And I think that it's given black people, and I don't want to speak about more than black folks because I don't know someone else's experience, but I think it also kind of gives us a bit of, like, a translating feature that, like, other people just won't have, right? Like, I know that this story is true. I believe that this story is true because there are plenty of cues in here that I've heard somewhere else that I know that this has happened plenty of other times. And I don't think white people just have that. I know that they don't, because they cannot hear things in the same way that we've heard things time and time again and experienced them the way that we have.
That takes us right to the anti part of this conversation, which connects to the hashtag that you launched, as well as these broader conversations and developments happening within the journalism and media industry in particular. And that's about the different difficulties that we have being black in some of these spaces. I know you, with your hashtag, you shared a story about working in a particular place. I don't know how much details you gonna say. So
yeah,
I
mean, I'm not gonna say, like, where I was or what station I was at, but it's some pretty easy math if you know enough about my resume. But I told a story about, like, the difficulties of working in a newsroom. And, like, I've worked in a few different newsrooms, and then I've been a freelancer for a long time, so I have a couple of different newsrooms to, like, draw experience from. But, like, I moved across the country to work at one particular outlet, one news station. And, like, I moved 2,500 miles in a span of only 3 weeks of even learning the job existed to, like, my first day there. And, like, within the first week, my boss, I remember it very vividly. We're walking out of a meeting and she's in the middle. My co-host is on her right and I'm on her left. And like, she turns to my co-host, who, one of my co-hosts, because there were three of us. And she says to her, you know, I just knew I wanted the sassy blonde with the attitude. And like, it's just like really, you know, giving her all this praise. And then halfway turns in my direction and just doesn't say anything as we're walking toward our desks. And like, that was my first week there. Right. Like,
see, you should have grabbed her and you should have shook her.
Now,
don't
see,
hit
if I want to snatch the hair or something,
you
like,
can't snatch the hair either. You just got to grab them by the shoulders and shake them. Just shake them. That's not assault. I'm like, just kidding, y'all.
That's not that was Travell Rajan. But like, that was my first week there, right? I moved to a city where I don't know anyone but her, who I've interviewed with, right? And like, I told a longer story on Twitter, but like, I dealt with all kinds of hell with her there all the time. Like, I would get praise from every other person in the building for being innovative and creative and all of these different things. And for us, like, quite frankly, like being number one in my department in social media across the country. But like, nothing I ever did was good enough for her. Mm. And then, you know, the truncated version is like, I later found out that like, there was another blonde white woman that she wanted in that position, not me. And like, no matter what I was going to do, I wasn't going to be able to be a blonde white woman for her. And like, I felt that I did not want you energy every single day that I was there. And that made me hate being there, right? Like, some days. But like, I also had to overcompensate all the time, right? Because I just want her to love me. I want her to think what I'm doing is good. I want her to, you know, be impressed with my work, give me a good review. And like, it was not going to come no matter what I did. But after Melania, honey, I had to come back to the town to speak to an NABJ there. And like, I was very excited to show up at my old office. And the tweets I was giving you, a very, hey, ooh, everything looks so good. You know what I mean? Like, I was thrilled. But like, I then saw her and like, she wanted to hug me and grin and all this. And I was just like, it was the most awkward moment for me because I was like, you were awful to me, but here you are like wanting to, you know, share in that moment. I was like, fuck you. Like, I don't like you. You made my life hell here. So, like that being, I was the only black man on air there. There were other black women that were on the air there, but like, it was a very difficult experience for me, being, you know, the black guy in that newsroom sitting across from this woman who did not want me there, who wanted a white woman in that role. And, you know, it made it really, really difficult.
Right. And one of the things right about us being sometimes the only, sometimes one of few, sometimes the only one who wants to speak up about what's going on is that there's all this like kind of fear and trepidation around like what the result or what the impact of you speaking up will be. And so we just internalize it and we just try to figure out, I must be the problem. How can I be better?
Yeah. Well, and like something white people never have to think about, in our editorial meetings in the morning, there was one journalist that would be in that morning meeting that was black. Right. And if she wasn't in that meeting, there was no black person in that meeting. And like, then you feel the weight of like, should I go over and be in that meeting? Because like, you have the responsibility of like having the black perspective, because there's only one black perspective, right? Like, if we have a black person in here, we've got enough. But like, having to like represent black people or like people of color and say like, actually that would really come across in a way that would be problematic for us. Or actually, I'm really offended by the way that we're framing that story. Or are we going to lead with that and include that photo? Like, white people don't have to represent white people.
And what it is, right, what we should be clear on, that's extra work, right? Yeah. That's extra labor beyond the job description that black folks and other folks of color as well, depending on the stories, but a lot of black folks, particularly in this one, have been sharing, that is what we have to shoulder, what we have to do, the responsibility, the extra responsibility that we have to take on in these particular spaces. And like, if you happen to be that black person who, you know, isn't interested, right, in shouldering that responsibility, which I believe is your right in whatever space you are in,
sure,
then
absolutely,
the coverage ends up being, you know, a perpetuation of all of the wrongs that have come before it, right?
Well, 100% that. So, like, two things. One, I was in a meeting earlier today, and, like, I was talking with a friend of mine who she has, like, she's like, all of us now have to be like diversity and inclusion experts. Like,
very that.
I'm a wedding planner. You know what I mean? Like, don't ask me questions about like why we don't have black planners and why we don't have this. And well, what should we be doing? Like, sweetie, I'm here to pick out the tablecloth and to give you like the idea on what the art should look like. I don't have to be your fucking, you know, diversity and inclusion expert as well. Like, being black has given me my experience or my perspective, but like, I didn't study diversity and inclusion. I didn't like, who are the people that you should be paying to answer you those questions? But then also, we did a panel for NABJLA where we talked with other black male journalists about covering these stories. And I asked the other black men on that panel, like, have you ever decided to say no to a story because like it was too hard to cover it, or you just weren't in the emotional space? And Tremaine Lee, who you guys may know from MSNBC, he hosted a podcast called Into America, and you see him often on as a national correspondent there. He said, like, I've never been able to say no because I'm always concerned about who's going to do the story if I don't.
Yeah.
And that is so true, right? Like, who is going to be the person that has a competent voice that is thoughtful and concerned and has care and finesse for this story to be able to tell it in a way that is fair and honest and like representative?
Yeah. So your story you just shared and the stuff you've been mentioning about the storytelling, right? That's about the coverage. That's about the content. I want to share a story about just like dealing with people, like personnel issues. And so when I was at the LA Times, I started the LA Times in a diversity fellowship program called MetPro, the Minority Editorial Training Program. It is allegedly supposed to be their way of like giving opportunities to folks of diverse backgrounds to get into the newsroom, on the job, work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Started that program in 2014. There was me and one other black person, black guy in particular, in this program. Oh, that's a lie. There was a black woman as well, but she was a photographer. So
the erasure.
No. It was different in terms of how the program worked out. Anyway, the other person who was there, his name is Jerome Campbell. Shout out to him. He's still doing journalism. And we kept getting confused for each other.
And y'all don't look nothing alike.
We don't look nothing alike. The only thing that we had in common, we both wore glasses, and we both had at the time a similar like high top fade-esque haircut.
But if the two of you were sitting next to each other, you don't even look related.
We're different skin tones. We dress differently. Like all of these different things that are just different about us. But consistently from our very first day until we left, we got confused for each other. And then another black reporter was hired. Dexter, who's now over at Vice, was hired. He is taller than both of us. He is skinnier than both of us. He is yellow like you. Okay.
I don't like also the had vitriol on that, but okay.
Also had a high top-esque haircut, though his was bigger than both of ours. And we were also, they just threw him into a loop and we were confused for him as well. So I actually got Jerome to record a little quick thing about his experience with all of this.
I've been mistaken for Travell mostly, but also Dexter. Travell and I used to work on separate floors, and yet I would be mistaken for him at least once a week. And then Dexter didn't show up until years after I had been there at the company. And there was one time when an employee who sat behind me turned around and said, "How are you liking your first week at the job?" And that was Dexter's like third day at the company. And that moment, of course, was probably very embarrassing for that person. But for me, it was really embarrassing too, because at that time, I was really struggling to figure out, was I of value to the paper? What was I adding? Did people know or care about what I was contributing? And in that moment, it felt like I didn't exist.
And so as you can see, these are like it. This is what we're talking about when we're talking about being like some of that extra shit that we have to deal with in a particular newsroom. Just being black. We don't even look like.
Well, I think part of what also white people never have to think about with this is how hard it becomes to find your footing, right? When you are having such a difficult time just trying to fit into a space, when you're trying to like feel appreciated or accepted in a space, when you are trying mm-hmm. to just feel like everybody else.
You want to feel like people care about you because they actually know your name.
Exactly. Exactly. Or they appreciate your work or they see value in you. And like, I know at my time at the station that I'm not naming, like, I never really felt like I found my footing. And like, I also like, again, was getting a lot of really good feedback from my bosses that were not that boss. Right. Mm-hmm. But like, I never felt like I was ever like really in my groove because I was always like trying to overcompensate and then trying to talk with our boss's boss about like why our relationship was so fucked up. And then talking with our national boss because I was trying to figure out like maybe I should do this or maybe I should mm-hmm. say that or maybe I should present it in this way. And you know what I mean? Like you never can like feel comfortable in your goddamn job because you are always trying to just fit, to feel welcome, to feel like you belong there. And that is really, really, really frustrating.
And sometimes you end up being preoccupied with all of that extra shit to where you can't even focus on the work. And sometimes the work falters because I got to deal with just trying to exist in this particular space. But this makes me think of like what I think is like why you and I both got involved with like NABJ, particularly NABJ LA. And we haven't said this yet, so I want to specify for the people who don't know what the alphabet soup is that we're talking about. NABJ is the National Association of Black Journalists. NABJ LA is their LA chapter, of which I am currently president and Jarrett is currently vice president. Jerome actually was vice president right before Jarrett. So it's a small community. How you doing? Hi. But, you know, the work that we do at NABJ LA in particular, but also on the national level, is about trying to support Black journalists who might be one of a handful in their particular newsroom who don't know or find difficulties trying to navigate that space, as well as holding newsrooms accountable for their lack of diversity, for their lack of resources and support for the journalists that are within their particular newsroom. And like, you know, we I'm not gonna say what I was just thinking.
Ooh, come on. Come on.
But
come
on. I know I'm not doing that.
Come on.
But what I will say is that I think these are the organizations, and they're right, there are organizations for some of the other communities, Asian American Journalists Association, National Association of Hispanic Journalists, NLGJ is the LGBTQ Journalists Association, NAJA is the Native American Journalists Association. Everybody got an association, well, not everybody, but, you know, a lot of the bodies got an association. And, like, the work that we do, I think, tries to, I don't know if solve is the right word, these issues, but at least try to help and assist Black journalists with better navigating them.
We've talked here before about like, it is not the job of Black and brown people to end racism, right? Like, we didn't create this shit. But like, we also see the value in like being able to counter the images that are being portrayed of us. And I think that there is a really high value in being able to say like, America is used to seeing Black men as criminals or entertainers or, you know, what have you. But like, we talked about last week, like, do you know about these Black architects? Like, yeah. Do you know about these Black chefs? Do you know about these people who are doing X, Y, and Z and that come from all different communities? Because we only give that space to white people in media and oftentimes in newsrooms. Like, we don't give enough space to be able to show, like, as Dr. DeGruy said last week, like, white people are not the majority of this world, right? But, like, they take up the majority of the conversation when it comes to media, when it comes to so many different places.
What would we want the industry to look like in terms of the experiences of Black journalists if we could, you know, if we could shabutaque it, you know, like Whitney Houston in Cinderella?
Shabutaque it?
Yeah, you know, bippity boppity boop.
Are those supposed to be the same thing?
Mm-hmm. They synonyms. Great.
So, I... The people at Webster's were like, I'm sorry, what? Okay, I think there are a couple of things, and you and I have started work on this, and it's been kind of difficult, but like I think that there needs to be like a lot of data on what these newsrooms look like. Mm-hmm. And I think that there should be studies and like consistent updates to those studies. There's a really, really great study that comes out of UCLA that is led by Darnell Hunt, who does the Hollywood diversity report, that really looks into like what television and film looks like as far as diversity is concerned. Travel and I have been working on developing something like that for the newsroom that would really look at what newsrooms look like in this market and across the country, because realistically, like these images that we send out into the world, mm-hmm. they go around the world. The United States has a unique position in the world of being able to like tell the stories that the whole world listens to. And if those stories are not accurate or not honest or not fair or not just downright factual, or handled with like the care that is necessary for like telling stories of marginalized communities, it has a negative impact around the world. I think I told you before, like when I was working on a cruise ship, that my roommate was from Brazil, and the only perspective that he had of Black men was us as rappers.
Yeah.
And he had a really difficult time wrapping his mind around like me as a Black man and like what to do with what he'd always thought of Black men. And like that is a failing of our media that we send out around the world, that like we don't have more diverse images of ourselves, and like having to like reshape someone's idea of what a Black person could be because he had never seen someone like myself. And so I think newsrooms we need to have more study of these newsrooms, and yeah. we need to have more of these outlets making commitments to what parity looks like, P-A-R-I-T-Y, what it looks like to actually be diverse and inclusive, because diversity and inclusion are two different words for a reason. Mm-hmm. So what do you think?
I mean, I would just add, in addition to the research, as our academics call it, I think there also needs to be the building of like actual leadership pipelines within these newsrooms.
Absolutely.
So that the on average younger, less experienced, newer, fresher voices that happen to be mostly of color at a lot of these places have a route, a path forward that they can grow into to eventually becoming, for example, the editor-in-chief of a particular publication. More often than not, there is no clear line of succession, I guess, in terms of how to grow in a particular space, how to get promotions in a particular space, how to negotiate appropriately in a Listen. Particular space. And so, like, I think it's incumbent upon news organizations to create those and to make sure that they are actually supporting and improving kind of the professional development of their folks within their newsroom, as well as folks from outside the newsroom. I think those two, both the research as well as kind of this leadership pipeline thing, is two quick things that folks could do.
You talked about the line of succession not existing, and I'll shout out Elle Michelle, who hosts a show called The Culture Soup. I was on her show last week, and we were discussing diversity and inclusion, but through the lens of like corporate America and this moment. And she was talking about, like, you know, there is no line from being the diversity and inclusion officer to being the head of the company. Right. Like mm-hmm. oftentimes companies don't even have like a chief diversity officer because they don't value it. And right. like, and if there is that person, like that person is not in line the same way like the CFO or the CCO or the C whomever O is to being the CEO. Right. Like that person is never going to be considered as like leading the company. Right. That yeah. is a very unusual scenario. But all of these companies allegedly like believe that it's important and, you know, value it and prioritize it. But like, That line of succession that you're talking about just does not exist.
Before we wrap up, I want to ask you one question to kind of try to put a bow on this conversation for us. And that question is like, where do you see yourself going from here? We're having these conversations about how difficult and how tiring and how stressful and all the other adverbs and adjectives it is being a Black journalist, particularly in these moments, right, where we're having kind of broader national, global conversations around race. Where do you see yourself going from here in terms of journalism.
I have to be honest and say, like, my heart rate has gone up knowing that we are going to say this here at the end or ask this question, because I don't feel like I'm supposed to say what I'm about to say, but I'm really burned out. And I don't know how much longer I'm going to be a journalist, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm. And that's only at 45 years old.
Now, if I were to Freddy Krueger and reach through this camera, then I would be a bitch, right? I'm 35 years old, you black bastard. But I'm 18, almost 19 years in, right? Like, when I started as a reporter in my high school paper to now, like, I'm really, really getting tired. And like, I still think storytelling is really important. And I still think like facts matter and all of that shit. But like, I feel myself burning out when it comes to news, mm-hmm. and like being a news junkie and like always having to keep my finger on the pulse of everything. And like, to be wholly honest, I don't know how much longer I'm going to be a journalist. And like, I don't know. Like, I could see myself mm-hmm. going into more screenwriting. I could see myself going into like something else and like maybe some kind of advocacy or D&I work or diversity and inclusion work. But like, I don't know how long I stay in as a journalist. Now, mind you, the last time I said that was at 2:00 in the afternoon on July 19th, 2016. And, you know, a few hours later, I broke the Melania story. And like, I felt like the God, the universe, the all was like, no, stay your ass right here. And so like, I don't know what will happen, but like, I do feel like, I feel like I can see the off ramps coming up on this highway, if you will. So what about you? Where do you see yourself going forward?
You know, so I've had the opportunity over the last year or so to be like courted for positions outside of journalism. And I've generally said no to all of them because I told myself, oh, girl, you got to give it a few more years. Like, you can do it. I know you're tired of shouldering the entire community on your back when you are trying to do your reporting and all of that. But, like, it's I think that it's for a greater purpose. And I think that it's for, you know, I want to be part of that. You know, they say journalism is like the first draft of history or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to be part of that because I want to make sure that when people look back at this time period and they use the media that we produce today to reflect this time period, I want people like me to be accurately reflected, right? Then again, I'm tired of shit, you know? Yeah. And I haven't been doing it as long as you. I also love that, like, you count your high school years and your college years in your career. So if we're doing that, I'm like, I think if my math is right, I'm like 12 years or so in, mm-hmm. If we're doing that. And it is a lot. And it is tiring. And, like, you know, I'm a spring chicken still. You know, I don't have wrinkles like
honey,
you do.
You're giving me, like, autumn hen at this point. I don't know what you're But I think what you're saying, though, is important because, like, you feel a sense of responsibility. And, like, one of the things that we talked about with the black male journalists was, like, how often do you feel like you're just taking one for the team and how many times do you do that, right? And mm-hmm. how long do mm-hmm. you continue, yes. like, making that sacrifice for the business or making the sacrifice for the community or for the culture or for, you know, the story or whatever? And, like, I don't know how much longer I'm doing that. I don't know.
Yeah, me either. I'm gonna let y'all know now, if the right opportunity comes its way,
listen,
I will hang up this journalism situation. But also, if the right opportunity comes this way, I will put back on the journalism, you know, situation. You know, I'm flexible is what I'm saying.
Well, and I mean, you know very well, like, offline, like, there have been some cool opportunities that have arisen that I've been very interested in. And if the right thing were to come and, like, you know, the right money were offered. And, like, you know, it's the right opportunity. Listen, if it's the right opportunity, like, yeah, okay, maybe I'll stay here for a few more years.
But also,
the struggle is hard.
And the last thing I was just going to say is that, you know, we shouldn't have to make these decisions based off of money. Like, we should be able to say, oh, I love the work that I do. I want to continue doing this for the rest of my life. You know, we shouldn't have to worry about all that extra shit that we have to shoulder in order to do the thing that we love.
Absolutely.
And I do encourage people to look into the work that, like, we're doing at NABJLA, but there are chapters across the entire country, and then there's the national organization. You can get more information about NABJLA at nabjla.org. With that being said, if you, any of yous out there that are listening, if you got thoughts about the editorial reckoning that is happening, let us know at Fanti Podcast on all the socials and at fanti@maximumfun.org. When we come back, we're going to get into some of your feedback and our lovely, lovely dishonorable mentions.
Video games.
Video games.
Video games. You like them?
Maybe you wish you had more time for them.
Maybe you want to know the best ones to play.
Maybe you want to know what happens to Mario when he dies.
In that case, you should check out Triple Click. It's a brand new podcast about video games.
A podcast about video games? But I don't have time for that.
Sure you do. Once a week, kick back as three video game experts give you everything from critical takes on the hottest new releases,
to scoops, interviews, and explanations about how video games work,
to fascinating and sometimes weird stories about the games we love.
Triple Click is hosted by me, Kirk Hamilton.
Me, Jason Schreier.
And me, Maddie Myers.
You can find Triple Click wherever you get your podcasts and listen at MaximumFun.org.
Bye.
All right, welcome back to Fanti. It is now time for our dishonorable mentions. These are the stories or people that caught our attention this week that deserve a call out for either they're good or they're just downright stupid. Travel, we are going to let you start because you got something that you that's really burning in your loins.
Do I? So first, actually, I think my first honorable mention ish is going to go in relation to our Fanti of this week, and it's going to go to the LA Times. They finally made the decision after some very heated conversations, as I'm told, within the newsroom, that they're now going to be capitalizing the B in black when they are referring to black people, people of the African diaspora. I know I don't, you and I have worked both in like white media and in black media, and in more often than not, in black media, they capitalize B, but in white media on average, it is lowercase. And so I think that is just, I won't applaud. And by applaud, I mean just like one finger on top of another finger. the LA Times for catching up and coming into 2020.
I mean, to be fair, like they are way ahead of a lot of other places, right? Like this
Bury
is something that,
yes.
Our national organization at NABJ is like working on initiatives to change it in AP style. Do you want to say really quickly, like why you capitalized the B?
You capitalized the B because I'm a bad B. I'm just kidding.
Wow. We'll put that in the pitch deck to the AP. But like, I know for myself, I started capitalizing the B because black is a term that is all encompassing of, you know, darker skinned folks from the African diaspora. But like, so many of us don't have connection to that. And so being able to like, acknowledge like our existence with a capital B as opposed to a lowercase b, like it, because blackness is a thing now, right? Like it exists. It matters and has value. So I've been capitalizing the B now for years.
I started doing it in undergrad, actually, at Morehouse. It was our, you know, student newspaper style, and so I've been doing it all along.
I find myself having to remind myself like the color black doesn't require a B. If I'm that like part. Oh, you're looking for the black and white one, oh wait, that's a little, like I always do that. Okay. I want to give a dishonorable mention to congressional Democrats for this weird kente cloth moment that they had on Monday. I tweeted about this and I thought, like, listen, so we love the sentiment. Love what you were trying to do here. We appreciate the shout out. But this execution was some bullshit. Like, what was that? Like, listen, who said to you, I am willing to be wrong on this. And, you know, we come out on Thursday. We tape this on Tuesday. Maybe someone will tell me that I am wrong. But I feel confident that that was not a black person. That was like, everybody put on this kente and take a knee for 8.5 minutes. I just don't believe that.
Listen, we know that white people love Wakanda. We did a whole episode on it. So here we are.
Oh, my God. If they had done like the crossed arms, like I would have been... done. Okay, what you
they
got?
Were close. So my next honorable mention, I actually want to give an honorable mention to the best graduation speaker ever, Miss Beyonce Giselle Knowles Carter. She was a part of the, you know, the massive like 2020 graduate, like, collection of speeches from all these different celebrities mm-hmm. that, like, Barack Obama and Michelle Obama, like, kind of, I guess, helped orchestrate and, like, put their name on. And she gave a really, what I found to be a very rousing speech to the current generation of DaBabies about this particular moment that they are coming out into the world. And in particular, she made she made a point of shouting out queer folks, as well as black, like, queerness and blackness within the same listen to it.
To all those who feel different, if you're a part of a group that's called other, a group that does not get the chance to be center stage, build your own stage and make them see you. Your queerness is beautiful. Your blackness is beautiful. Your compassion, your understanding, your fight for people who may be different from you is beautiful.
Oh, glory.
Don't you feel it? Didn't it just undergird your identity and your existence? Beyoncé can't do no wrong. We all know this. But she did what needed to be done.
Our overlord and slayer. I appreciate it. Okay.
What's your next honorable mention?
I want to give a dishonorable mention to Georgia. As of Tuesday, again, when we taped this show, we have seen so many instances of voter suppression happening in Georgia, and, like, it is fucking infuriating. And, like, the idea that Governor Kemp, who is the former Secretary of State, who in that state runs elections, is now governor, and, like, we're seeing, one of the things that I saw on Twitter today was someone tweeting about how all of the voting machines in a precinct did not work. And, like, and it was from Ron Clark, who's a white man who runs this really, really dope academy, the Ron Clark Academy. It's like a charter school, I think. And he was saying, like, everyone there was standing in line already for an hour or something like that. And now everyone's having to go and do paper because the machines didn't work. Like, that is fucking ridiculous. And, like, white people, if you do not see the voter suppression happening in this country, it's because your eyes are closed and so are your ears. So keep up.
My last honorable mention is actually going out to the young black actors, actresses, musicians, etc., that are out here putting them, like, in the streets along with these other activists. I want to give a shout out to Kiki Palmer and John Boyega, to be specific. There's this video going around of Kiki Palmer talking, you know, right in front of, I think they're military personnel.
National Guard.
National Guard, about this moment, about, like, wanting them to do more.
We all stand together with the community, with society, to stop the governmental oppression, period. We need you.
And then John Boyega has been, like, he's been doing what Shameik Moore should have been doing.
We are a physical representation of our support for George Floyd.
Being aware of, like, the moment and using their platform to advocate in favor of the moment and in support of these protests, and not worrying about whatever potential blackballing that might come from them speaking up and speaking out about their experiences. Also, gonna give a shout out to Amber Riley, who, you know, you're in partnership with. You're about to say all this in a minute, but, like, shout out to her as well. Tessa Thompson has been out in the streets. Michael B. Jordan has been out in the streets. Like, all of these folks, you know, who are doing what needs to be done. And then last but not least, you have...
I'm giving myself a goddamn honorable mention this week.
You do that.
I've
done it twice already.
Listen, I was here. I was here. I was supposed to be off Friday afternoon into Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. And Friday evening, I had an idea that required me to spend all of that time working. And so... off day starts tomorrow, but I will, I launched this hashtag called Every Day, based on the idea that we experience everyday racism every day. And so I've written a piece on Medium. The link to that piece is in our, episode description, but I just really want to shout out, not myself, but I want to shout out all of the people who have been sharing their stories in the Everyday hashtag, and really being able to describe what everyday racism looks like and feels like and how it impacts them. The story I told earlier, I am in much more detail in a tweet thread, explaining, like, what it was like to move to that city and work with that person. I'm just really, really grateful for all of the folks who participated. I also want to shout out Amber Riley, who I am in partnership with this, because you guys may or may not know Amber Riley from Glee. I had this moment with Lea Michele that's a whole other conversation. You can Google that. But like, it sparked her into being able to use the moment that she was, you know, kind of thrust into when with the hashtag unmutiny. Unmute is unmute NY. And being able to really highlight the experiences of Black and brown people who are in the entertainment industry and like having difficulty in casting, in writers' rooms, in, you know, as actors and as producers and all that kind of stuff. So thank you to everyone who's been using the everyday hashtag. If you are a Black person who wants to talk about your experiences with anti-Blackness and racism, you can tweet using the hashtag everyday. And again, the piece from Medium is in our episode description. So that.
Yes. And now we're going to get into listener feedback before we wrap this mother up. Second time I referenced it, sure did. Wow. you have something from, I believe, our Instagram?
Yes, I believe, and I forgive me, I can't tell how your name is spelled because you have one of those cool font things that I can't figure out how people do on Instagram. So I think your name is Rev Nemelka. I don't know. But you sent us this letter on Instagram, and it says the following. Hi, Fanti. Hey. it says, I have a true Fanti question after finding out some unfortunate news about Sean King. Do we stan or no? I've recently reposted some of his posts because TBQFH, which I believe is to be quite fucking honest. Yes. And is my new favorite acronym. He's got a great feed for bringing police brutality to the surface, but just read about his fundraising fraud. No, ma'am. Have y'all been reposting him? Just curious what your thoughts are. I've genuinely learned and seen so much from his accounts, but don't want to support someone that Black people don't support. Would love to hear back. Love you. Love the show.
Ooh,
I've heard every episode, etc. All right. Wow. Moving on. We are going to... say thank you for listening to the show. My name is Jarrett.
You're childish.
This is a production.
Really?
Okay, so we're gonna have to talk about Sean King at some point.
Yes.
So in full transparency, like, I knew Sean 10 years ago. Sean was a pastor before he was an activist, and I went to his church in Atlanta, and he was a great pastor, and I liked him a lot, and he kind of pivoted into activism right after the earthquake that happened in Haiti and was like sending tons of tents, and like we were all a part of that. And then he left the church and became an activist and, you know, became like the person that everyone knows now. I don't know Sean now. Like, I have had like a little bit of interaction with him like sporadically over the years, but I don't know him anymore. And so it's been
Is it safe to say that we're gonna do an episode on him?
I think that's going to happen. I've reached out
because there's so much reporting, right?
There's a lot. I've reached out to him. One of the things that I've really wanted to do on the show is have the person we're talking about be on the show with us. And so I've reached out to Sean and we've not really spoken yet about this, but maybe we kind of have to. Yeah.
And particularly in this moment. So thank you, Rev Nemelka. We don't know how to say your name, but you know who you are.
You know who you are.
What really matters. As always, we love hearing you all's feedback, whether it's via email, whether it's via the Twitter DMs or the Twinstagram. I was about to say Twinstagram.
I was like, what are you trying to say?
Instagram DMs.
And we see all the messages. Like, when you guys email us, we see them. Like,
they come directly to us.
Yeah.
And so, as always, you can leave a 5-star review on iTunes. It's the best way to help the show get more known? Let more people know about the show.
He uses English for a living, you guys.
Every now and again. You also can always show us your support by becoming a Max Fund member at MaximumFund.org/join, and you can help us keep the show going and help us, you know, be able to produce it at the level that we would like to. As always, send us your thoughts on the topic, your thoughts on past episodes. All can be done at Fanti Podcast on all the socials or Fanti@MaximumFund.org.
Can you get the air horns ready? Because I'm going to need them in a moment. We want to thank Corrice, who does does our music. He created it. You can check out Corice anywhere you get your Slayworthy audio at cor.ece. And also our creative director, Ashley Nguyen, who did our photos and she did the cool graphics in our videos. Shout out to her. She's at I Am Ashwin on Instagram. Our producers this week are Laura Swisher and also Jordan Cowley. This is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.
Here we go.
Scroll down to the bottom.
Stop trying to be the boss of me.
But, okay.